morning. My name is Michael McCusker. To start today's program, once again, we are in a flag flap brought on by the great white dope in the White House. So here are a couple of responses, one by me. But first, veterans don't get to decide what respecting the flag means. And it's written by Salil Puri, who served in Afghanistan, and he wrote this for the Washington Post. Nike must have known when it began its new ad campaign with Colin Kaepernick, who started the kneeling protest in the NFL, that it was courting controversy. Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything, the text says, superimposed over Kaepernick's close-up. Veterans, not as stoic or stiff-lipped today as we once were, have been some of the most agitated about Nike's choice, resulting in plenty of righteous indignation. The five soldiers I served with who were killed in action 8 years ago in Kandahar would surely define sacrificing everything differently than Nike does. But while most veterans have been measured in their responses, one strand of criticism is particularly disturbing. The notion that kneeling during the anthem is a specific affront to veterans and service members. As Kurt Schlichter, a combat veteran and contributor for Fox News, put it, Kaepernick, quote, is targeting us. He knows what this means to us. He knows how insulting it is. He knows how disrespectful it is, and Nike is empowering it, unquote. In a Facebook group for veterans that I belong to, someone wrote, anyone not respecting our flag should be deported. Many veterans and servicemen and women have died and suffered grievous wounds for this flag and anthem and Constitution. Have some respect. This argument isn't new. Last year, the veterans of foreign wars and the American Legion chastised the protests as disrespectful. This reasoning is rooted in a premise that is both wrong and dangerous. If kneeling for the anthem and the flag is a direct offense toward the military, that means veterans have a stronger claim to these symbols than Americans in general do. The argument insists that American iconography represents us more than it represents anyone else. Yet the flag is not a symbol reserved for the military. It is a symbol of the United States of America, and it belongs equally to all citizens, including Americans who kneel during the anthem, or those who wear flag shirts, which is also in violation of the unenforceable flag code, or even those who burn the flag. If we accept the idea that the military and veterans have authority over American symbols, we enforce a very narrow minority view of America and the American experience. Our cultural fabric is as rich as it is because the American myth has been interpreted, reinterpreted, criticized, praised, and challenged by Americans of all backgrounds. If the military class were the arbiter of taste and ideology with regard to our iconography, we have had a lot more of 13 Hours, the bogus and hagiographical Benghazi movie, and a lot less of Stripes or Catch 22. We are not an elite class of citizen elevated above our neighbors. When we start thinking of ourselves as a warrior caste, removed from the people we defend, we exacerbate the civilian-military divide. We indulge in an entitlement mentality that isn't healthy, demanding special treatment such as discounts or restrictions on fireworks that might upset vets with post-traumatic stress disorder. The message is, you're welcome for my service. We should be able to dislike something without seeing it as a personal affront. We should be able to oppose something without becoming frothy-mouthed and obsessed, as some veterans online have done over Nike's ads. We should embrace Special Forces veteran Nate Boyer's insistence that we show compassion for those we don't agree with, while also acknowledging that everyone is free to boycott and destroy their Nike gear as they see fit. What's more, believing that we have a special claim to the flag conflicts with the fundamental values of the armed forces, which elevate service over self. Serving is an honor the American people grant us, and it is Americans in their totality whom we serve. This does not give us license to appropriate national symbols as our own exclusive banners. Service is a privilege, not a way to purchase greater moral authority. And that was, Veterans Don't Get to Decide What Respecting the Flag Means, by Salel Puri. And he was a staff sergeant in PSYOPS and served in the war in Afghanistan and currently is with what is called the Culper Group as a consultant. And he wrote this for the Washington Post. And now what I wrote and have rewritten and been on this program a couple of times. Flags passing by. Whenever an American flag is unfurled, I feel that I am a stranger instead of a citizen. I don't dislike the flag. I just feel that flag wavers and I live in separate countries. Flags are everywhere, in public places, of course, but they bloom also from houses, offices, automobiles, stenciled on T-shirts, and worn as lapel pins. These persistent and nagging proclamations of Americanhood, which might be reasonable though rude in a foreign country, seem discriminatory and shabbily neurotic here at home. I am sure that most people who feel a compulsion to mark their identity with a flag believe in freedom and democracy for themselves and those they regard as like themselves, but I doubt they feel the same passion about the rights and liberties of others who practice a different religion, or none, or have a different skin color, or are recent immigrants. The flag conceals more than it illuminates. Its red stripes represent the blood shed by the early patriots, who, if one needs to be reminded, were traitors. The stars are symbols of conquest, the brutal displacement of one civilization by another. Some of our citizens veil themselves with flags, merging self-perceived inadequacies with the civic inequities and empirical ambitions disguised by fervent nationalism. Underneath the patriotic bunting can be sensed the grim frenzy and unforgiving intolerance for new ideas and those who engage in them. The pledge of allegiance to the flag that children must say every day in public schools, which contains the phrase, "One nation under God," is the national school prayer. A flag is, after all, a tribal totem, relatively unsophisticated in an expanding global civilization in which such iconoclastic relics of humanity's immaturity should be displayed only in museums. Yet people still do get upset when someone trods upon a flag or blows a nose on its stars or stripes. Making shirts of flags or burning them in public protest gives police and some military veterans, not all, apoplexy. Patriots, poor, confused souls who think their personal lives would improve if the USA dominated the earth, roar with anger and anguish because desecrating, and that's in quotes, the flag is protected by the Constitution's guarantee of free speech and is in character with the precepts of democracy. A piece of cloth, whatever its mythological imperative, is not to be placed above human rights. What is freedom worth if, in dissent against its loss, its symbols cannot be dramatically abused? Symbols are powerful. They define purpose, hold people together, but separate them also. Humanity is crossbreeding at an incredible rate. Primitive icons of separateness are increasingly meaningless. Our species will truly be free when it is able to abandon the symbols that perpetuate its divisions. The many tribes no longer need their special banners and bunting, except as family talismans put away for memory. I do not participate in flag ceremonies or attend parades in which legions of flags are marched past me. For a few years, I was obliged to salute the flag twice a day during its raising and lowering, and when I was at war for the flag, I dreaded that it would swaddle my corpse. I would not spit on the flag because I don't think a flag is that important. Why should anyone care if someone burns a flag or makes love on one? And that was Flags Passing By, which I wrote. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington. Real heroes versus tarnished heroes. The recent tribute and celebration of the life of Senator John McCain, coupled with the anniversary of 9/11, prompt me to reconsider what the word hero really means. John McCain is widely regarded as a genuine Vietnam War hero, undergoing torture and refusing to succumb to enemy demands. I don't question his valor, but do wonder if in fact he simply found himself in harm's way, flying over Hanoi. Perhaps he was merely conducting a mission ordered by his superiors. Not putting himself in harm's way, but finding himself in harm's way, may tarnish McCain's reputation a bit as a genuine war hero. Just wondering. I'm also reflecting on the late senator's political accomplishments. He did present himself as a political maverick of sorts, though I'm wondering how much of a contrived, sustained effort that was. McCain backed President George W. Bush about 90% of the time and on numerous occasions sponsored or backed legislation I find objectionable. He voted to make the Bush tax cuts permanent, opposed universal health care, opposed the federal minimum wage proposal, and issued his famous Bomb Iran chant. Yet the senator did assume more reasonable and more moderate positions on occasions. Nevertheless, I still harbor some reservations about John McCain's send-off as a true American hero. And I'm still looking for heroes to emulate, troubled by our lazy, careless, often irresponsible use of that word, hero. Perhaps we have stretched the meaning to include anyone caught in harm's way, rather than placing themselves in harm's way. Of course, I admire and respect people who commit courageous acts. They deserve to be labeled gallant, intrepid, noble, or valorous. But let's get one thing straight about what the word hero really means in 2018, a year tarnished by the non-heroic acts of Donald Trump and his crime family. Genuine heroes articulate our aspirations, exemplifying courage, selflessness, and grace. Genuine heroes serve as war models for others, committing brave deeds and selfless acts, choosing to sacrifice in order to benefit others. Genuine heroes are not talented celebrity athletes who put on a uniform while receiving seven-figure incomes, nor are they others who simply put on a uniform to perform the job they're paid to do. Genuine heroes aren't in our comic books and are seldom discovered in our legislative bodies. Genuine heroes aren't the beloved small-town doctors who charge just $5 a visit. They may be nice, but they're not heroes. Nor are the victims of natural disasters or mass shootings who find themselves in harm's way. It's not heroic to beat cancer or to prevail in any other endeavor if your motivation is saving or advancing your own derriere. And when we blur that important distinction, we make excuses for losing, and we elevate undeserving souls into hero status. And that is wrong. Not everyone who died on 9/11 was a hero. The stock traders, receptionists, cooks, waiters, and building maintenance workers didn't die for their country. They died because they went to work. I doubt that any of them would have shown up for work on 9/11 if you had told them they would die as a result. That's why I reserve my use of the word hero for extraordinary people. The real heroes of 9/11 were not ordinary citizens displaying two flags on their cars or trucks or wearing NYFD hats, New York Fire Department. Patriotic, perhaps, but heroic? No. The real 9/11 heroes were the courageous firemen and police who, knowing full well the likelihood of perishing in the inferno, risked everything to rescue victims at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. I don't know about you, but that's what the word hero means to me. And that was Real Heroes versus Tarnished Heroes by Dr. Robert Brake, who is a retired college professor and lives in Ocean Park, Washington. He is a frequent contributor to the Chinook Observer and to this program. He wrote recently to me, "Best regards from a fellow left-hander who was born into a Catholic family and flunked the first grade owing to his handedness." And as he said, he ultimately earned a PhD. And this was in response to my recent rant as a softpaw papist. And now, something that I have written and which I have also written and rewritten, Forever 9/11. For the past 17 years, the new millennial American angst is that it is forever 9/11. A highly charged intrapersonal nightmare that a hijacked jet airplane loaded with hapless captives is aimed at all our windows. It is a nightmare that has proved recklessly fruitful for homeland fearmongers of terrorist paranoia and for ultra-nationalist phobias stoked at high fever since 9/11. There are few certainties among the disingenuous layers of intrigue and deceit. Principally among them, that the war on terror, so-called, is no nearer closure than the day it ostensibly began with that astonishing surprise attack on the USA that congealed the calendar at 9/11. Yet there are two other 9/11s of violent and pertinent consequence that we might consider. The earlier and more repellent being the bloody U.S.-supported coup in Chile on Tuesday, September 11, 1973, that toppled a popularly elected government and murdered its president, Salvador Allende, who had attempted a form of socialist democracy with extensive land reform and seizure of American-controlled corporations that previously dominated Chilean affairs, said to be around 3,000 U.S. firms. The CIA and U.S. paramilitary personnel were deeply involved in establishing the Pinochet dictatorship that imprisoned, murdered, and executed multiple thousands of Chilean citizens. They shoot you for just being left-handed, a person victimized by Chilean police and soldiers said, until democracy was restored without U.S. assistance in 1990. The other 9/11 of concern happened in Libya in 2012 when Muslim militants attacked the American embassy in Benghazi and killed the U.S. ambassador and three other Americans, which resulted in an extensive and long-running partisan witch hunt, and I put that in quotes, against Hillary Clinton in particular, who had been Secretary of State at the time, and President Barack Obama. The results were inconclusive and a vast waste of taxpayer money. As for the 9/11 we commemorated Tuesday, which was also on a Tuesday, latest estimates are that the deaths from disease incurred by nearly everyone who volunteered to rescue bodies and clear away the highly toxically contaminated debris at Ground Zero will soon outnumber those thousands who were killed that day. It took nearly a year, and the exposure was immense, which includes firefighters and cops who survived 9/11 and worked on the pile for months afterward. Medical accountability and care has been inconsistent and negligent. And now, two poems about 9/11, each by a young woman who grew up in Astoria. The first by Jesse Duncan. September 11th. Thunder in the wind, no rain. Peace mourns its passing, no pain. We are still human, but our existence is vain. Do we not bleed and die? It is always the same refrain. Nothing is right. Terrorism shakes its ugly mane. Are we not all human? Do we not feel pain? Peace comes to an end as the old moon wanes. Jets fly overhead. We decide to take trains. We are struck by horror. We are struck by pain. What do we do when the time comes again? Send our boys into battle. Watch them die in vain. Peace waves goodbye as war says hello again. And that was by Jessie Duncan, who wrote this poem right after 9/11 when she was 16. And it appeared in the January, February 2002 Times Eagle, North Coast Times Eagle. And now by Margaret Boulder, Snow on New York City, 2001. Snow falls on the city, soft pattering, muting traffic, footsteps on slick sidewalk, stark glaring headlights of taxis, endless curtain of white, one yet many, stifling, drifting, slanted, creamy sky, white snow, imperceptibly one ends and the other begins. Snow somehow pulls away, separates from sky, mingling with gray of ruins ash. It's winter now in New York, across the United States, in Afghanistan as well, and snow is falling on the city. The Empire State Building, frosted white, the Chrysler Building, snowy. Snow is cloaking the people, spattering black leather jackets, umbrellas, ice crystals gathering on the backs of volunteers, sifting through the rubble of the towers, trying to find the remains of yet another human soul. It's winter 2001-2002, and snow is falling on New York and amid the broken towers, crushed. Nearby storm drains, choked with ash, now overflow with snow. No one bothers to clean them. A lone flag stands atop the ruins, not hampered by the weather. Red, white, and blue, the only colors apart from the gray of the towers, waving proudly. New York has been dealt a blow too cruel for words to express. Dumbfounded, we watched our blaring TV screens, witnessed the World Trade Towers crumble. Many have donated money to help victims' families, to aid in the excavation. I have too small a sum. I am too young to volunteer. So all I have to offer are these empty words, trying to make sense of a tragedy that, in an instant, brought a nation to its knees and created a date that would live forever on in infamy, 9/11/01. And that was by Margaret Boulder. And she was 12 years old when she visited New York City on Veterans Day weekend in 2001. And she has been an award-winning poet and the author of The Christmas Eve Ball. And now, speaking of the Star-Spangled Banner and the National Anthem, on today's date, September 13, 1814, Francis Scott Key wrote his poem, Star-Spangled Banner, when British ships bombarded Fort McHenry at Baltimore, Maryland, during the War of 1812. And also today, on 9/13/1899, the first recorded automobile traffic fatality in the USA occurred when a motorist in New York City ran over a pedestrian at Central Park West and 74th Street. Names were withheld pending notification and adjudication. And would you know, 205 years ago this past September 7th, 1813, Uncle Sam was born as an old man with whiskers, a top hat, and star-spangled whoop-de-doo in a Troy, New York newspaper, obviously replacing Yankee Doodle Dandy as the American icon, or brand, in the current common parlance. And to end this program, the quicker than anticipated pace of world climate change is spawning more numerous and stupendous cyclonic storms across the rising oceans. One such massive storm is expected to strike the American mainland today and through the weekend. This new colossal hurricane roaring toward the southern east coast is named Florence. So was my paternal grandmother, whom I think of as Glossy Flossie for her parvenu pretensions. Donald Trump's flagrantly self-congratulatory response to the oncoming tempest has been to boast that Puerto Rico, which has had a cumulative death toll from last year's Hurricane Maria of 3,000 plus, nearly equal to the dead of 9/11, was a tremendous unsung success. But, Trump says, Puerto Rico is an inaccessible island, very difficult to land emergency and medical supplies, which brings to mind an old World War II saying, tell it to the Marines. This is Michael McCusker.